Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up...
It's up to you, using your intelligence, your life experience, and your common sense, to evaluate the evidence.
The jury enters day two of deliberations in the Bella Bond murder trial. We'll talk about some of the last-minute changes to jury instructions that could have an impact on their decision. Also today, Uber CEO Travis Kalanick is out following months of investigations into the company's toxic work culture. Is his departure a sign that American business is losing patience with macho leadership? And a Massachusetts midwife returns home from the middle of the European migrant crisis. She spent 3 months on a Doctors Without Borders rescue boat in the Mediterranean Sea. Plus, I got you stuck off the realness. We be the infamous, you heard of us. Official Queensbridge. Remembering rap revolutionary Prodigy. That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Jury deliberations continue today in the Bella Bond murder trial. The jurors must decide whether defendant Michael McCarthy is guilty of killing the 2-year-old toddler whose remains were found on Deer Island in 2015. Now, there were a couple of strange things that happened towards the end of this trial, some late decisions made by the Suffolk Superior Court judge that have enraged McCarthy's defense team, and we want to explore those complications. So here to explain is Brad Bailey. He's a criminal defense attorney not affiliated with this case. He's also a former assistant district attorney for Middlesex County and former assistant U.S. attorney in Boston. Brad Bailey, welcome to you.
My pleasure to be here.
We're really glad to have you because a couple of things happened late in this case which honestly left me quite confused. And I'm hoping you can help us set the record straight in terms of whether or not these things are unusual and how common they are in Massachusetts courtrooms.
Sure.
So the first thing is that on Monday, Judge Sanders at the Suffolk Superior Court actually agreed to a request by the prosecution to add involuntary manslaughter to the list of possible verdicts in this case against Michael McCarthy. I mean, that's really late in the trial to add a possible verdict, isn't it?
Well, jury instructions and what charges are submitted to the jury are usually decided upon and discussed at the close of the evidence, but before the parties make closing arguments. So the timing of that particular decision wasn't that unusual. And in Massachusetts, whenever there's a first-degree murder case, the jury and the defendant is entitled to consider a second-degree murder charge as a lesser included offense. But very often in these murder cases, there's real argument over whether or not manslaughter or the derivative of manslaughter, involuntary manslaughter, also has a basis to be submitted to the jury. Usually it's the defense that's arguing or asking for that. So it was a little bit unusual that it was the prosecution, but it wasn't that unusual that manslaughter was being debated at that point and at that time.
Okay, interesting. Now tell us, what's the sort of legal distinctions between first or second degree murder and manslaughter?
Well, in this particular case, under these facts, while it's an unlawful killing under involuntary manslaughter, it's an unlawful killing that was unintentionally caused under this theory by a battery which the defendant knew or should have known created a high degree of likelihood that substantial harm would result to another. So it's not the intentional killing and the malice aforethought that is required in the murder charges. In fact, it's an unintentional causation charge, but under circumstances where, as in this case, if believed or if the facts support it, that punching or striking a toddler with force on the body should have foreseeably been seen to have a high degree of likelihood that substantial harm might result.
So I think the thing that I struggle with, I'm a little confused by being a legal layperson here, is this a new charge that they're adding? And if so, how is a defense team supposed to craft a defense if things are getting added so late in the trial?
Well, it's certainly something that the defense argued vociferously that there was really no basis in the evidence to submit that or support that. And that's really what any appellate court is going to look at, if that was wrong for Judge Sanders to have allowed the jury to consider it. Was there a basis? Was there any sort of interpretation of the evidence where that should have been submitted? And again, it's unusual that it was the prosecution and not the defense requesting it. And I think it suggests that the prosecution realizes there are some real issues with its proof and with its case. But the bigger issue is what happened after argument yesterday, where the prosecutor requested an instruction suggesting that they didn't have to show that Michael McCarthy alone was responsible for the death.
Well, so hang on for a second, Brad, if you could, because we actually have tape from court of this exact moment that you're talking about. First of all, just to sort of set some context, we are going to hear from Jonathan Shapiro. He's Michael McCarthy's defense attorney, and this is what he said during his closing arguments, that in Jonathan Shapiro's eyes, that jurors need to acquit Michael McCarthy if they do not believe he's the sole perpetrator of this crime.
The question that will be facing you when you deliberate on a verdict is whether the prosecution has proven beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. McCarthy, and only Mr. McCarthy, murdered Bella Bond.
So again, that's Jonathan Shapiro, defense attorney, and I'm guessing he's making that explicit argument because of Rochelle Bond, Bella Bond's mother, who was a witness for the prosecution, obviously a problematic person in this case. But then after the closing arguments, Judge Sanders told the jury this.
Mr. Shapiro stated, I think at the beginning of his closing argument, that you can find Mr. McCarthy guilty only if you conclude that Mr. McCarthy and Mr. McCarthy alone killed Bella. As to that, I would simply instruct you as follows. The Commonwealth bears the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. McCarthy killed Bella. On the other hand, the Commonwealth does not have the burden of excluding the possibility that one or more other persons were also involved in the crime.
Brad Bailey, what does this mean?
Well, it certainly means that there was a real shift in the Commonwealth or the prosecution's theory of the case. And to have that come after closings and after the defense's entire defense was based on the theory that there was nobody else who could possibly have done it except either Mr. McCarthy in the eyes of the Commonwealth or Rochelle Bond in the eyes of the defense, that's amounts to completely sandbagging and potentially sabotaging his entire case, because according to Mr. Shapiro, he had never been placed on any type of notice that the Commonwealth might suggest that the evidence would show that somebody other than Michael McCarthy committed this murder. And so he had every right to be upset, not just by the substance of that particular charge, but by the timing, because presumably he had every right to assume that these issues were all vetted at the pre-charge conference that happened before the closing. And he based his entire closing on that.
Brad, can I just ask you, I mean, it seems as if this is my conjecture, okay? But it seems as if these changes happened late in the trial because, as you said, the Commonwealth may have recognized that its case possibly wasn't as strong as it would have liked it to be. Okay. But on the other hand, there's the question of the fundamental fairness of what goes on in a courtroom. I mean, did these late decisions, could they possibly be grounds for a claim of mistrial by McCarthy and his defense team?
Well, I think that they may well be grounds for a possible viable appeal and or a new trial. And I think that they will be revisited if, in fact, he is convicted of either first or second degree murder in this case. Now, the prosecution is going to counter on appeal that the defense opened the door by stepping into the role of judge during their closing argument and instructing the jury on a proposition that the judge found to be improper. And therefore, they invited the correction that throws a monkey wrench into their argument. But again, there's no stretch of any aspect of the Commonwealth's case where they suggested that. And beyond that, this was not a situation where Rochelle Bond was originally charged with murder,
mm-hmm.
and then the charges were reduced to accessory after the fact. She has been charged consistently with accessory after the fact, so there's been no notice to the defense whatsoever. And also, one has to wonder about the way the charge was given, in that it's clearly on a joint venture theory of liability.
Yeah.
But where's the full instruction on helping the jury to understand the application and the meaning of a joint venture murder? So there are issues that absolutely will be revisited on appeal and may resonate if, in fact, there is a guilty verdict on first or second degree murder here.
Such strange complications to a really tragic, tragic case. We'll keep our eyes on what happens with the jury as they continue to deliberate, and of course their decision when they make it. Brad Bailey, criminal defense attorney, former assistant district attorney for Middlesex County, and former assistant U.S. attorney in Boston, thank you so much for walking us through these delicate questions. Much appreciated.
Thanks for inviting me to join you.
Well, by now you've probably heard that Uber CEO Travis Kalanick resigned late last night. And though he's still on the company's board, his ouster really feels like the almost inevitable conclusion to months of bad press and investigations into the company's machismo, toe-stepping, super-pumped workplace culture. Snarky air quotes there, for those were the corporate values espoused by Kalanick himself, which translated in reality to a company riddled with sexual harassment and discrimination. So this is a good thing, right? That the CEO of a troubled, enormous organization can be held to account. Well, some in the business media think so. The magazine Fast Company put up this celebratory blog post with the title, "Travis Kalanick's Uber Exit is Another Nail in the Coffin for Toxic Masculinity in Workplace Culture." Dude. Well, obviously, I'm dubious, and I added the dude there part, but let's get some actual perspective from one of Boston's business leaders, Jessie Mermel. She's president of the Alliance for Business Leadership, a nonpartisan coalition of CEOs and investors focused on sustainability and social responsibility. Jessie Mermel, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Magna. How many times can we say dude during this conversation?
Bruh, I don't know. Let's challenge each other.
Yeah.
A nail in the coffin for toxic masculinity and workplace culture, what do you think?
You know, I'd subscribe to that if Uber started out in 2009 with a culture that welcomed and embraced and was comfortable for women, people of color. You know, that would have been the real nail in the coffin, that such a huge company understood the value of taking that path and went there from the get-go. Don't get me wrong. I think that what's happened to Travis Kalanick is the right thing. But I'd be in a bit more celebratory of a mood if we were talking about how Uber came out of the gate embracing these values, because it wasn't just the right thing to do, but they also knew it was good for business.
I mean, isn't that the point here? Because it seems to me that Uber would not have found itself in the place that it is today if Susan Fowler, back in February, didn't have the courage to go public in a way where she not only described, you know, actions that she had experienced in terms of sexual harassment and terrible HR policies at Uber, But that blog post that she wrote that really blew the lid off of this talked about how the entire company really was just riddled with this stuff, and we wouldn't have known Unless she had gone public.
And we have to imagine she was not the first, right? You know, Uber has been around since 2009. She came out a mere few months ago. She was not the first. She was just the first who found herself in a position to be able to come forward. And, you know, we all owe her a lot for that. That takes a great amount of courage, but no woman or employee of any stripe should have to feel that way in their workplace.
But so how much can change then if you know, Kalanick is out? There's obviously a bunch of other C-suite level folks who are out at Uber now. There's change afoot at the board, although Kalanick himself is still going to be at the board. I mean, is that enough to really change the culture of a workplace that was so, whose corporate identity was really built around this machismo? I mean, Susan Fowler was writing things like, you know, she was held to account by HR for complaints that she made. You know, an HR officer told her, you know, the commonality here is that you're the one making the complaint.
No, it's atrocious. And the idea that he's staying on the board is laughable. It makes me feel like they're maybe looking for the PR points of making this change than really internalizing a major culture shift. You know, they're going to need to bring in a CEO who is serious about creating a new culture in their company. We know that about 20 Uber executives have been fired over the past few months. They're going to need to make sure that any remaining bad apples are gone. And then they're going to need to get serious about changing their culture. And I think that's going to be really hard. In some ways, I have to point out, you know, I work with the Uber team here in Boston and have had nothing but wonderful experiences with a largely female and diverse leadership team. So, you know, I want to be careful not to paint every Uber employee with a broad stroke, but clearly the corporate culture at the top was incredibly toxic. And by the way, it's not just because, you know, it's a really bad thing and people's feelings are getting hurt. For as hard charging as Uber likes to think that they have been, they have inevitably left money on the table by creating a sexist, discriminatory, intolerant culture. Mm-hmm. All the studies bear out that it is bad for business when you don't create an inclusive environment.
Well, I mean, Uber finally came out with its first report on employee diversity just this past March, and they found that report, again from Uber itself, found that 36% of the company's employees, this doesn't include drivers, but 36% are women, 50% of the employees are white, 31% Asian, only 9% African American, and just under 6% Hispanic. I mean, honestly, that puts them right in line with the rest of tech, doesn't it?
But it's 2017, and for a company that claims to be on the cutting edge of everything, the fact that they were okay with being right in line with everyone else, but not okay with being right in line with everyone else in other areas of their job and their corporate culture, I think says everything.
Jesse, how much does what's happening at Uber, Kalanick being forced out by investors, no less, who I'm presuming saw the same things you were saying earlier, that it's just bad business to have corporate culture like this, but how much of this is going to possibly redound across the rest of Silicon Valley or business leadership as a whole? Are other CEOs going to look up and take note and say, maybe we ought to change how we do things too?
I hope so. I'm trying not to be cynical about this. I'm trying to bring some optimism to the situation. You know, there are a portion of business leaders who are motivated by what is simply the right thing to do. But for others, they need to see how this impacts their bottom line. And certainly what Uber has experienced over the past few months illustrates that in very, very clear terms. But the research has been abundantly clear for decades. You know, MIT reported in 2014 that offices with a 50-50 gender split saw their revenue go up by 41%. McKinsey has released multiple studies along these lines. So I hope that this is the giant frying pan that hits corporate America over the head and makes them wake up, because the information has been out there. They just need to have a light bulb moment and, you know, dude, fingers crossed that this is it.
I keep coming back to this idea again and again, though, and I couldn't let it go all day, Jesse. So help me set me straight here. We wouldn't have arrived here if one person, at least Susan Fowler, didn't have the courage to come forward. I mean, that's the thing that gets me. It's not like Uber is going through this giant, wonderful, noble act of self-examination out of the goodness of its own heart. It was forced to do this by a courageous woman.
I mean, tale as old as time, right? you know, this isn't a unique situation for Uber, both in terms of sexism in the workplace and in terms of requiring, you know, one person who in some way felt other feeling brave enough to come forward. And unfortunately, I don't think we're going to be seeing the end of those types of examples anytime soon. But yes, I don't know that that's a great answer for you, Meghna, but other than to say I completely and totally agree with you. We are not here because of some deep soul searching on the part of Uber or any other company. We are here because, you know, someone decided she couldn't take it anymore and wouldn't let her colleagues take it anymore and stood up for herself and on their behalf, and she should be roundly applauded.
Well, I keep coming back to this, Jesse, because, I mean, I guess it comes back. What I'm wondering is, it wasn't leadership that forced the change, right? It was someone who just couldn't take it anymore. And hopefully there will be other leaders out there who say, well, let's not risk that. Let's change our house right now. I mean, is that possible? I mean, is there a generational shift going on here? Is there, a growth in the recognition of the facts that you were talking about earlier about the strengths and business advantages that diversity brings? I mean, is there really change afoot more than my cynical, hard-bitten news reporter self is feeling right now?
Yes, but it is slower than it needs to be. You know, I can tell you that so many of the business leaders who we work with at the Alliance for Business Leadership feel this way, but the shift, as you pointed out, is noticeable from a generational perspective. These things typically don't have to be explained when I'm talking to, you know, a new CEO who's, you know, in their 20s or 30s and launching a startup. They totally get it. It's their values, and they understand, you know, the business value to doing these types of things. But I think it's going to take allies at all levels, and Susan has proved that, right? You're completely correct. This was not corporate leadership at Uber forcing this change. This was a woman smack dab in the middle of the company. And so women are going to have to stand up for themselves and for other women, but women and people of color are going to need, and by the way, people in the disability community, the LGBTQ community, we can go on down the list, are going to need people who don't look like them to be allies. Not that we need battles fought for us, but you need people to have your back and to amplify your message. And so we have to turn to leadership to help us make these changes, but we also have to turn to our allies and understand that we all need to wage this battle together.
So not quite a nail in the coffin yet.
A step in the right direction, but I'm not... I'm not going out for drinks to celebrate tonight.
Okay. Jesse Mermel helping, keeping it real here, dude.
Dude, thanks, Meghna.
Jesse Mermel is the president of the Alliance for Business Leadership, talking to us about the lessons from the resignation of Uber CEO Travis Kalanick. Jesse, thank you very, very much.
My pleasure.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It is Wednesday, which means it's time for sports with Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Good afternoon to you, Bill.
Hey, Meghna.
Let's talk about the NBA draft. It begins tomorrow. And what is this? The 76ers and not the Celtics have the first pick? What happened?
Well, there's nothing untoward, I can assure you.
Okay.
As part of a Celtics strategy, which remains shrouded in a certain amount of mystery, as such strategies frequently do, when multi-year considerations are in play.
I see.
You trade for something that you might have benefited from today for something that you hope you will benefit from in 2018 or 2019 or somewhere down the line when you get the picks that you're getting in response to the ones that you're giving up.
I see. So they're taking a longer-term
strategy. That's sufficiently clear, don't you think?
Yeah, well, now that you
click,
have
click,
explained
click,
it.
Click, click, go dials all over radio
indeed
land.
Indeed it has. Well, but, so the Celtics made a similar deal back in the 80s when they traded a number one pick for a number three pick.
Right. Worked out pretty well. Ended up with Robert Parrish and Kevin McHale. Not too shabby.
Okay, so it works. Okay.
Yeah. Of course, there were some differences, some distinctions between today and 1981. Of course, was Red Auerbach was still there in 1980. Now, whether Danny Ainge can be the second coming of Red Auerbach remains to be seen in this particular instance.
He has time yet to prove that.
Absolutely. And that's the other thing about draft picks. People can celebrate on draft night and say, oh, this is great. We got so-and-so. And then so-and-so turns out to be not quite as good as everybody thought he would be. And some guy drafted down in the, you know, mid-teens or even lower turns out to be a world beater.
Hmm. Well, let's shift gears here away from the Celtics' third round pick, I should say, for this year. And to
number three pick in the first round, to be accurate.
Okay. Oh, well, so that's a big difference. And thank you for the correction.
Right.
But let's move on to news out of the Supreme Court that has an impact on the world of sports, because the court ruled that the government cannot deny a trademark registration because a name is potentially offensive, the name of a product or a group or a company. Now, this case was brought to court over the use of the name, I'm going to say this because it's actually the name, The Slants, and an Asian American band wanted to use this name. But the implications here for sports are that there are many teams, including Washington's NFL team, that have been facing a lot of pressure to change their names.
Mm-hmm.
So what's your response to the court's ruling?
Well, would I be too skeptical if I were to point out that there's nobody on the Supreme Court who's ever been referred to by that particular R word? That is the nickname of the football team that does business in Washington, D.C.
Are you pointing to the lack of diversity on the United States Supreme Court?
Yeah, in this particular respect. And this strikes me as, I don't know. People have to make up their own minds on this sort of thing, I suppose, and the Supreme Court has apparently made up its mind. But the overwhelming evidence is that most people who were most sensitive to this issue consider that word a slur, mm-hmm. a racial slur. And for the people running the Redskins to continue to call the team that seems to me not only insensitive, but pretty stupid in terms of a business practice. But there are lots of people who are, very serious about their allegiance to the team as named. And so far, they've prevailed.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, the Supreme Court made its ruling, so perhaps no legal recourse for people who don't like Washington's name. But there's always protesting with your wallet,
yeah,
right?
There's protesting with your wallet. There's also the fact that numbers of people in the world of sports no longer call the team by that name.
Mm.
On Only a Game, for example, I refer to it as the franchise doing business in Washington, D.C. There are people with whom I speak on the program who continue to use the nickname of the team or the official name of the team, but I don't, and lots of people don't.
Well, so there are multiple ways then to have your voice heard. Let's move on to golfing news, because in October, the PGA is going to be – you're laughing already. They're going to be changing their drug policies.
Well,
is this not a good thing?
They are changing their drug policy. They're going to be able to draw blood and test players. My favorite response to this comes from the ever-dependable Golf Week magazine, which this is why it's a good thing, according to Golf Week, and I'm quoting, "The PGA Tour attracts fans in part because the athletes are incredibly clean living lads, and the new policy and anticipated absence of announcements of drug cheats will only reinforce their purity and quiet those who've been suspicious." Tiger Woods and John Daly come to mind.
Are we talking about the same sport here?
If this wasn't written tongue-in-cheek, I'm completely baffled by it. I'm very uncomfortable with this because, unlike, for example, Major League Baseball, there is nothing on the golf tour that resembles a players association. So there's no negotiation. The people who run the tour simply say, here's what we're going to do. And if an individual player were to stand up and say, wait a minute, I don't like the idea of your drawing blood from my arm when there's no reason to suspect that I'm cheating. You're just doing it because you have the right, as you have said, mm-hmm. you have the right that you've given yourself to do this. There's no negotiation. Baseball, the Players Association negotiates with the people representing the owners and the league, and they come to some sort of compromise. Yeah, you can test. You can do it this many times a year. This is the penalties. This is how it's going to work. I don't like the idea that management can simply impose this on a group of athletes, even a group of athletes as lavishly compensated as the people who play golf on the PGA Tour.
There's always the counter argument, Bill, though, that you should have nothing to worry if you've got nothing to hide.
Yeah, and that's an argument with which I'm fairly uncomfortable. It's a little bit of, as far as I'm concerned, an autocratic / fascist argument. Perhaps in these days I'm slightly sensitive to such
to autocracy and
such
fascism
an interpretation, but I'm uncomfortable with that, and especially since we're talking about blood testing, we're not talking about urine testing, and how far removed is that from any citizen doing anything being subject to that kind of invasive testing?
Well, actually, that's a really good point, right? Because if we just reframed what we're thinking about a little bit, it's their workplace.
The other excuse, of course, is golf is back in the Olympics. The Olympics have drug testing, yada, yada, yada. So golf has to be, to some extent, consistent with the Olympics, the context in which the game will be played. But likewise, Olympians, many of them children or only just past childhood, have no particular rights in these issues. And for most of them, or many of them, there's no reason to anticipate that they'll test positive. There's no reason to expect that they've broken any rules or laws.
Well, I wanted to quickly touch on one more story, Bill, because it's one that we've come to again and again. It's an important one. This has to do with the NFL and brain damage, because NFL player Warren Sapp just said yesterday that he's going to be donating his brain to the Concussion Legacy Foundation after he dies. Now, Sapp, who made the announcement in a video for the Players Tribune, he details the problems he has had with memory loss and functioning since leaving the NFL.
You try to find a reason that it's not that it's my brain, that I'm not deteriorating right before my own eyes. It's the most frightening feeling, but it's also a very weakening feeling, because you feel like a child. I need help.
Now, Bill, Sapp said the reason why he decided to donate his brain was because of an email that he received from an NFL owner that disputed any connection between football, chronic brain injury, suicides, and, quote, all this foolish stuff. What's your response?
Well, I just wish that NFL owner would look at the results of the testing right here at Boston University, where the overwhelming majority of the brains that have been tested, the brains of former NFL players, have shown signs of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE. You cannot make that argument anymore. Even the NFL, which clung to that argument and paid doctors to present that argument for years, simply cannot hold on to it. It's basically the same argument that the tobacco industry put forward for so long. Oh, there's simply no evidence that smoking has any link to cancer, until it was overwhelmingly demonstrated that they were wrong, and they got sued and money talked and they got clobbered, and then, of course, started to sell their product overseas instead of here. But the NFL cannot make that argument with any degree of credibility any longer, and yet some individuals continue to do it.
Well, Bill Littlefield is host of NPR's Only a Game. You can hear him every Saturday on WBUR at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. and Wednesdays right here with us at Radio Boston. Bill, thank you as always.
Thank you, Magna.
Move up, so to all the killers and the $100 billers. I got you stuck off the realness. We be the infamous, you heard of us. Official Queensbridge murderers. Tomorrow comes equipped for warfare. Beware of my crime family who got enough shots to share.
Well, you're listening to Shook Ones by the hip-hop duo Mobb Deep. The lead rapper of the group, Prodigy, died yesterday. He was just 42 years old. Now, an official cause of death has yet to be determined, but a publicist for the group issued a statement saying that Prodigy was hospitalized in Las Vegas for complications due to sickle cell anemia. Now, this morning, when we were discussing Prodigy's death in our editorial meeting, one of our producers talked about Prodigy and what his music meant to him specifically. And so we thought we'd invite him in. Sean Bowden, he's a producer here at Radio Boston. And Sean, good to see you on this side of the glass here.
Hello, Megan. It's different over here.
Well, so first of all, Prodigy is a very big name in hip-hop. But for those who don't know a lot about his life or his music, just tell us a little bit more about him.
So Prodigy was one half of the rap duo Mobb Deep. We say Prodigy was the lead rapper. Really, they shared roles as rappers, but he was the better rapper of the two. Havoc, he was the producer. They came out in 1993 with their first album called Juvenile Hell. They were young. They released eight albums together, and Prodigy released four solo albums of his own. They had one platinum album thanks to a single that featured Lil' Kim, but beyond that one platinum album, they really had a following in underground hip-hop more so than popular mainstream hip-hop.
Yeah, no, he grew up in Queens, right?
He did. He grew up in the Queensbridge Projects, which is an infamous project when it comes to hip-hop history. A lot of big names have come out of that community.
So tell me more about what was it about his music and his rap that made it so special?
He had this uncanny ability to connect with a very specific audience. I mean, he was on a major label, but at the same time, it felt as though he was talking to a particular group of people who felt no one else was talking to them. People who grew up in the projects, people who grew up in ghetto America in late 80s, early 90s. And there were other rap groups that did that. But when I think of Mobb Deep and I think of Prodigy, I sort of differentiate them between groups like NWA, who talked about things like that, but in a cartoonish manner. The way Prodigy did it, he said things that you couldn't pick up unless you experienced that life, unless you've seen it, unless you went through it. So you and I may be listening to his record, and there may be something that resonates with me that may not resonate with you, and that made him special.
Well, let me ask you, because I was looking at some of the lyrics in Shook Ones, actually, and there's this line, "I'm only 19, but my mind is old." Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
That's exactly the kind of thing.
So what is he saying there that reached you so much?
I wasn't 19 at the time. I was probably 15, 16 at the time. But I definitely felt older based on my experiences. And hearing someone like him say something like that, a little snippet like that lyric, like, "I'm only 19, but my mind is old. And when the things get for real, my warm heart turns cold." It's just, yeah, like that happened to me yesterday when I had that encounter with so-and-so, or when I lay down in my bed and I thought about some of the experiences that I've had in my short life.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't so much the gruesomeness of his lyrics. It was little gems like that. And his ability to set a scene that if you'd been there, you knew it. I also remember the cadence in his voice. Mm. It wasn't always his lyrics. He also had this flow to him that a lot of times people think about rap and they don't respect the musicality of it until they try it.
Yeah.
Like, oh, wait, it's not just talking for 4 minutes, right? So he had this cadence about him that it seemed as though it flowed with the rhythm of the street, with the rhythm of the projects.
Do you have another track here that you want to talk about that describes that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, let's play Hell on Earth.
Me, me, you must be petty. Don't tempt me. I had this full clip for so long and needs to empty. The reason why I fool for so long, cause I don't waste it. You properly hit blood in your mouth so you can taste it. Quiet is kept. I lay back and watch the world spin. I hear thugs claiming that they're gonna rob them all when they see us. I tell you what, Black, here's the issue. It's a package deal. You rob me, you take these missiles along with that. I ain't to average.
What do you love about that?
It's aggressiveness. It's grittiness. It's to be honest with you, it's violent, but being a adolescent male and growing up in a certain environment, it was cathartic to listen to. I wasn't attracted to it because I wanted to go out and do violence. It was like I got this on my chest and I got to get it off.
Mm-hmm.
Like people are talking about what's going on in my community, but there aren't too many of us who are, or, you know, like, Let me explain it in graphic detail, but I just got to get this off my chest. I got to release this energy. And he sort of talks about that himself. He did an interview on NPR, and he talked about you know, this isn't me trying to call anyone out or target them. This is sort of me just letting it out.
It gave me a life. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Because my life before hip-hop was just pain. Like, sickle cell was my life before hip-hop. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I ain't really have no life. That was it. You know, I'm growing up, and just that's all I knew was just being in the hospital all the time. Mm-hmm. And then music, when I first started hearing, like, Run DMC, LL, My Radio, and, you know, the Juice Crew and all that, I started seeing all of that. You know, the aggressiveness of it just attracted me to hip-hop because I was angry inside. I was an angry kid because of the sickle cell, and so I liked the anger in hip-hop. So that's what attracted me to it. That's what made me want to do it. It helped me get my aggression out.
As Prodigy, speaking to NPR back in 2013, interesting that he brought in his sickle cell into part of the potent mix that gave birth to his art, I'm going to call it that. But the thing, that, Sean, that I'm wondering is that obviously Mobb Deep was a very important part of hip-hop, and they have a loyal fan base, platinum album, as you talked about, but maybe they're not the household name that some other rap duos or groups are from or have that came out of the same era. Well, why do you think that is?
Well, number one, that era of hip-hop was tremendous. So their peers are still considered the greatest of all time right now. So they were competing with Nas, they were competing with Tupac, competing with Biggie, competing with Jay-Z, competing with everyone who lived in the same housing development as them. Mm-hmm. And those are some of the giants of the genre. And they also didn't make an attempt to water down their music or add catchy singing or hooks or dress in costume for their music videos, right? They weren't in the shiny costumes. They would take a camera crew, go to Queensbridge Projects and shoot a music video. Or, you know, they told gritty tales of crime or whatever mischief that they were getting into or their community were getting into, and they just let it play out. So if you didn't fully understand it, you just didn't. And so it was hard to make a mainstream crossover hit with that type of content.
So does that mean that you think or maybe not that there's a new artist or maybe someone on the horizon that could fill the particular gap that Prodigy's leaving?
No, there's no one to fill that gap. That era is dead and gone. It's not going to come back. The reality that they were living for better, really, is gone. And I'm talking about the crime rates in the early 90s in urban America. That's gone. So I don't think that we'll ever see someone else like Prodigy, someone who can describe what's going on and have an audience connect with it like he did on a track like Survival of the Fittest, for example.
There's a war going on outside, no man is safe from. Run, but you can't hide forever from these streets that we done took. You walking with your head down, scared to look.
Well, Sean Bowden is producer here for Radio Boston, talking to us about the legacy of hip-hop artist Prodigy, who died just yesterday. Sean, thank you so much.
Thank you, and it's surreal to hear Mobb Deep playing on WBUR, but I love it.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
And leave you with not much to go home with. My skin is thick, cause I'll be up in the mix of action. If I'm not at home, puffing live, relaxing. New York got it again depressed. So I wear a slug proof underneath my
guest. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Liza Ramlow spent 3 months in the middle of a crisis. She was a member of Doctors Without Borders, and she worked on a search and rescue boat scouring the Mediterranean Sea for refugees and migrants. Her crew picked up people fleeing Libya for refuge in Sicily and southern Italy. And the ones they found, however, they were the lucky ones, according to Doctors Without Borders, because one of every 41 people who attempted to leave Libya by boat have died trying. And as a midwife, Ramlow worked with many women who attempted to make the journey. She kept records of their stories and what they'd experienced, and she joins us now in the studio to talk about it. Liza Ramlow, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much.
So can you just tell us first briefly, you spent 3 months on the Aquarius, this boat operated by Doctors Without Borders. What was that like?
being on the boat.
Oh. Yeah. The experience of rescuing these migrants.
Yeah. Well, it was an amazing experience, which brought me, as you said, right into the middle of something that a worldwide crisis that I didn't understand as well as perhaps I could have when I went, but I sure understand it better now, having met the people who are truly in the middle of it. Mm-hmm. So being on the boat, we were out at sea in international waters, never close to the coast of Libya, never closer than 12 nautical miles. And then we were directed to the vessels, the ships in distress that were found by the rescue commission stationed in Italy. So they would send us, for the most part, to the boats we needed to find. And sometimes we found them on our own. They were these rubber boats that are very flimsy, or wooden boats that are cobbled together, not meant to go very far. So they make it just into international waters, and then they run out of fuel, or the boat starts to deflate and sink.
Yeah. Well, so if I could just jump in here.
Yep.
Forgive me for interrupting, but
of course.
But given that you're a midwife,
yep.
Right? I mean, a lot of the people that you assisted were women and children, I presume, as infants even, or pregnant women. I mean, and there were specific things that you learned about these women that I'd love to hear you tell us about, like the experience of their journeys.
Yeah. I think what I learned, the most central lesson, is that these days the best way to be accepted as an immigrant in another culture is to be a victim of conflict, victim of abuse of some kind, driven out of your country. That those are the people that we accept, and those are those people will find sanctuary, will find asylum. Mm-hmm. But what we ought to be doing, I think, is thinking of these people as the same kind of courageous people that our forebears were, who came to this country. They are absolutely amazing women. I can think, for instance, of a woman whose name was actually God's Choice, who she left the detention center when 42 women were shot by the guards in that place.
In Libya.
Not knowing where she was going, she ran, and she did make it to the beach. Women were killed on the beach. A couple of them were trampled to death right in front of her, but she persisted, got on the boat. And on the boat, she stood for 9 hours because she knew that if she sat down, it would be dangerous for her. One of the fatalities that we encountered was another woman on that boat who was, in fact, sat upon and trampled to death. It's a kind of a panicky situation when a boat like that starts to go down. But God's Choice knew what she wanted to do. And one of the amazing statements that she made to me was that she really was seeking an education. She wanted to support her family back home in Nigeria. And she said, with education, there is one light shining in the family, which will shine on the others. So I can't disappoint my family. I must succeed.
Did you encounter many women who had experienced, because I've been seeing stories about this, like sexual violence?
Yeah. One of my jobs was to help those women tell their stories, to make a safe space for them so they could tell those stories, and we could offer them what medical treatment we have available post that kind of rape.
So was it common?
Yeah, very common. Rape is used in that setting in Libya as a tool of subjugation and control. And that's beatings and rape are used with men and women alike.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, because I'm just mindful that I don't want to run out of time before I ask you a couple of important questions, I think. I'm very glad to hear you tell us your stories and what you witnessed while working in the Mediterranean, because we happen to be in the beginning of a summer where we're not talking a lot about the migrant crisis, whereas a couple of summers ago it was in the news every single day practically.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, I mean, has the flow of migrants reduced, or is it just that we're not paying attention as much as we were?
It has not reduced at all. No, people, despite the dangers, despite what life is like in the human trafficking center that is Libya, people are making that journey because they want a better life for themselves, for their families, and they don't know how to achieve it in their own countries where governments are challenged to put together an infrastructure that works for all their people, for instance.
Did you witness, were there times where your boat, the Aquarius, wasn't able to get to people fast enough?
Yeah. I think once we had the boats in our sight, we were able to take care of them. We had an amazing rescue team in the SOS people. They were fantastic in what they did. They were the ones who actually got the people off the boats. But we would be so busy with some boats that we couldn't attend to others that were just a little bit of a distance away. Sometimes there were other actors in the area who could help, and sometimes there were not.
Hmm. And just, we have a couple of seconds left. Now, you actually, do I have this right? You came out of retirement to work with Doctors Without Borders?
Yeah. Well, I worked for 30 years as a midwife in Greenfield, Massachusetts, and then I actually retired so I could do this work.
I see.
I'd wanted for a long time to be a midwife with Doctors Without Borders.
Well, Liza Ramlo is a midwife with Doctors Without Borders, and she recently returned from a 3-month stint with the group on a rescue ship in the Mediterranean Sea. Liza Ramlo, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.